egalitarian and emancipatory spirit of Islam and the Sharia. And thus, on the 25th of January 2004, after a decade of feminist action, more than a decade actually, at least 12 years of feminist action, and several years of intense debate and consultation, the Moroccan parliament passed a series of sweeping revisions to the Madawana. The reform of Morocco's highly patriarchal family law was regarded as a landmark event, and the new code was heralded as a giant leap in women's rights, as well as a huge advance in children's rights. With the new code, Morocco joined Tunisia and Turkey as the only countries in the Middle East and North Africa region where the husband and wife have shared responsibility for the family. As one feminist leader, Latifa Jabadi, told me when I was interviewing her and others about the family law reform, she said, "Nous avons cassé le tabou. We have broken the taboo. We managed to break the taboo." So subsequently, mechanisms were designed to implement the reform and elicit societal acceptance. New family courts were established in support of the reformed family code. Training for the judiciary was improved, and women could now be appointed as family judges. State agencies and women's organizations worked together to raise popular awareness about the new law and women's rights through education, media campaigns, and other activities. And to top it all, in 2008, the government lifted all reservations to the Women's Convention, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. So the Moroccan case is a striking example of how women's rights activists can build coalitions to generate social dialogues, to have an impact on key policy debates, and to help effect legal reform and public policy changes, and this in a very culturally conservative country. In Morocco, feminist success derived from at least four things. One, their strategic use of Islamic sources and an emancipatory interpretation of Sharia to frame the new family law. Two, arguments about the need to fully involve women in all aspects of public life in order to further socioeconomic development and help alleviate poverty. Three, very effective coalition building within civil society. And four, and this is very important, the key ingredient that is missing in the case that I will be telling you about in a moment, a state feminist alliance made possible by the political opening of 1997-98. Now, the Iranian case. Following the 1979 revolution against the Shah, the Khomeini Islamist faction proceeded with their Islamization project, including compulsory veiling. With the abrogation of the Liberal Family Protection Act of the previous regime, the Shah's Pahlavi state, an exceedingly conservative set of family laws were written into the civil code. The new articles strengthened or returned men's privileges in polygamy, divorce, child custody, extramarital affairs. We have this Shia innovation in Iran, which is called sireh, temporary marriage, which allows a man to have unlimited extramarital affairs, which a wife obviously cannot have. And the law also allowed full authority of the husband over his wife. Also adopted was a criminal code based on the Sharia. Among other things, it prescribes stoning for adultery, and it sets the so-called blood money of a woman at half of that of a man. With the end of the Iran-Iraq War in 1988 and the death of Khomeini the following year, some relaxation. The 1980s were terribly ideological and very difficult years in Iran, but some relaxation was permitted in the 1990s under the presidency of Hashemi Rafsanjani. And it was at this time, in the early part of the 1990s, that women's rights advocates began to mobilize, albeit very quietly and discreetly. One manifestation of the emerging women's rights movement in Iran was what some of us who were studying this abroad came to call Islamic feminism. And we saw this Islamic feminist tendency in a new magazine that was produced in Iran called Zanon, or Women. In 1997, the election to the presidency of Mohammad Khatami greatly extended that period of liberalization that had begun under Rafsanjani. And it allowed new freedoms to the press, the artistic community, and civil society groups. And that period under Khatami permitted the formation of women's non-governmental organizations, as well as a very lively feminist press. During his two terms, the two terms of President Khatami, various groups within civil society, including student groups, groups of intellectuals, and others, called for greater political and cultural reforms. And many of the women who formed publishing houses and a feminist press and so on during this period were supportive of that reform movement, but they did not do anything publicly and openly. And they were also a little critical of some of the reformist male intellectuals for ignoring women's rights issues. So there was a certain period of opening in the 1990s and the latter part of the 1990s and into the new century. But when you compare the Khatami government with the Yousafi government in Morocco, the two were quite different. Because compared to the Yousafi government, the government of Khatami was very mild in its approach to change and to women's rights. Moreover, the reform movement in Iran was opposed by conservative and neo-fundamentalist elements within the state, and its progress was constantly blocked by three of the key institutions that were controlled by the fundamentalists: the Office of the Supreme Leader, the Zbeirat-e Faqih, the Guardian Council that I mentioned earlier, and of course the judiciary. Arrests and other types of repression occurred in increasing numbers after 1998. So on the one hand, you have this cultural opening and so on, and a lot of encouragement of a press and feminist groups and so on, but at the same time, the conservatives were blocking progress and they were also engaging in a lot of repression and, in fact, in a number of assassinations. For example, in the summer of 1999, the very lively and dynamic student movement was crushed rather brutally, actually. By 2005, it appeared that the reformist faction within the state had exhausted its possibilities, and it had reached the limits of its capacity to modify the political and social realities. In the midst of the second round of elections, the women's rights activists organized a peaceful protest on the 12th of June, 2005, in front of the University of Tehran. This, by the way, was the first time that women had publicly protested for women's rights since March of 1997. So this was in June 2005. Their grievance, obviously, was the second-class citizenship of women and the role of the Constitution in codifying and reinforcing gender inequality and blocking social change. The vast powers and veto authority that the Constitution confers on the Supreme Leader and the Guardian Council were correctly seen by the feminist activists as serving to obstruct reform bills and impede change in the status of women. 6,000 women and men joined the 2005 protest in Tehran. The protest event issued a statement entitled "Our Protest Against Violations of Women's Rights in the Iranian Constitution." And within days, 1,000 people had signed a public declaration, which was also posted online, calling upon the Iranian state to change discriminatory laws with regard to women. Women's NGOs from major cities and even in some of the smaller provincial towns announced their support of the women's initiative. So this June 2005 example of feminist collective action, again, the first time since March of 79, represented a clarion call for an independent women's rights movement which also audaciously targeted the Islamic constitution and the inequalities embedded in the Iranian legal system as obstacles to gender justice. Now, shortly after the election to the presidency of Ahmadinejad, he declared his vision for Iranian society, which was a blend of neo-fundamentalism and nationalist fervor, with a focus on developing nuclear power. He declared that any internal opposition to his vision would constitute a threat to national security. As a result, when women's rights activists gathered in central Tehran in June of 2006 to commemorate the first anniversary of the women's protests, more than 30 of them were arrested by the police, charged with endangering national security. This list of demands was posted on blogs and widely distributed on the internet. Now, at first glance, these look like very reasonable demands that could easily be addressed by the Islamic Republic, by the authorities. On the other hand, they also directly challenge the whole raison d'etre, the purpose, the identity of the Islamic Republic and of the Islamic Constitution. So in a sense, when Ahmadinejad says that the feminist activists are endangering national security, they may not really be endangering national security, but they are posing a most fundamental challenge to the identity and objectives of the Islamic Republic and of the Islamic Constitution. Alas, so even though they are, as I was saying to Suvarna, they are almost Gandhian in their approach to social movements and social change, they are constantly being arrested and harassed. Now, what is interesting, though, about the Iranian feminist campaign, although they challenge the government and the whole, in a sense, the whole Islamic system, they also draw on national and cultural frames for legitimacy and also to resonate with different publics. You know, in a way, for example, as you all know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., with the civil rights movement, also drew on constitutional language and religious language, which resonated very much with diverse American publics. So the Iranian feminists have tried to do the same too. In what way? First, they strategically drew on some aspects of the language of the Constitution and the law to defend their action and to justify their right to engage in peaceful protest. Believe it or not, the Iranian Constitution, the Islamic Constitution, does allow for peaceful protest and demonstration. It also bans torture. So they're actually violating their own constitution. Secondly, by designating, so they're called the century-old exams, the 100-year demands. What are they referring to here? They are referring to the Iranian constitutional revolution. Very, very popular constitutional revolution of the early part of the 1900s, which really resonates with the Iranian public. Third, the feminists argued that their nonviolent struggle for women's equality had always been within their, they use this word senf, their senfi parameters. Now, in Persian, what does senf mean? Senf literally means trade or guild or class. In Iranian political history, trade unionists often say that they are struggling for their senfi rights, and students say that they are struggling for their senfi rights. This is a way of distinguishing a legitimate struggle for sectoral rights from a presumably illegitimate political struggle. So, by referring to themselves as a cent, the women's rights activists were evoking a historical tradition, ranking themselves as a legitimate class of workers whose demands are independent of political factions or objectives. So, you know, this is part of the framing, the process that takes place in all social movements, and in this case, in the Iranian women's movement. Nonetheless, despite this type of framing, state repression continued with police brutality and the arrest of over 70 persons in 2006, including feminists, reporters, student activists, union activists, and a former MP, member of parliament, who now is living in the United States. Fatma, have you met you? Unlike the Moroccan case, the political environment in Iran was deteriorating rather than improving. So faced with state violence, activists in Iran decided to change their tactics and refrain from public protests. So they had the protests in 2005, they had protests in 2006, and that was the end. Instead, they decided to appeal no longer to the state, but to the public. And this is when they shifted their strategy from making demands on the state to launching the 1 million signatures campaign, which was adopted from the Moroccan experience of the early 1990s. So what is the campaign? The campaign is a grassroots effort to recruit support for women's equality. Activists go door to door, obtaining signatures from housewives, shopkeepers, they go to universities, they go to schools, they ride the buses, they take signatures from pedestrians, they go on the metro, they get signatures from commuters. And far from being, now the government likes to present the campaign workers as elitists and as bourgeois. From time to time they use, you know, Marxist terms, but very rarely. The 1 million signatures campaign has actually attracted many young women and men from lower middle class and religious families, as well as women from these families with martyrs. So it's not only the rich and elite young men and women from the northern and prosperous parts of Upper Tehran, northern Tehran, which is some of the claims and the accusations that are incorrectly made to the women's movement in Iran, unfortunately by some people in the United States too. In fact, this is broad-based socially. And the campaign has brought women's rights activists from various backgrounds and three generations, secular women and devout Muslim women alike, around a fluid, decentralized, and democratic network. What is more, the campaign has a men's committee, which is pretty large. So the campaign has branches in 16 provinces in Iran, as well as European countries, United States, and in some Persian Gulf countries. As such, the 1 million signatures campaign of Iran is both grassroots and transnational. And in that sense, it's a little different from the Moroccan case. The Moroccan case was almost entirely conducted within the borders of Morocco. Repression has continued, though, throughout 2008, 2009, and into this year as well. The authorities have arrested a number of activists associated with the campaign. They have confiscated the passports and computer files of others, and they have also forced a number of women's rights activists to leave the country and seek asylum abroad. The 1 million signatures campaign has received worldwide recognition, and it also has received a number of prestigious international awards. But it hasn't made much headway within Iran, in contrast to the Moroccan case. The Iranian government continues its offensive against Iran's feminist movement, and a number of feminist leaders have had to leave the country. Today, the objectives of family law reform and democratization remain elusive in Iran. But as one Chicago-based feminist with very close ties to the campaign said to me when I interviewed her about the campaign, she said, "I wouldn't say that the campaign has failed, although it's not doing so well." She said, "It has had a tremendous impact on the people." So, what does the comparison of these two feminist campaigns in Morocco and in Iran reveal? So while Moroccan feminists proceeded on the basis of a political opening, Iranian feminists have had to work with and within the context of a political closure. This slide here just summarizes some of the movement state dynamics in the two countries since the campaigns began in the early 1990s. So Moroccan feminists have helped to build a vibrant civil society and institutionalize women's organizations, while Iranian feminists have seen their presses, their centers, and their NGOs closed down. Whereas Moroccan feminists have been incorporated into the national polity, Iranian feminists have been represented as dissidents, and they have had to act extra-institutionally, outside of the formal institutions. Moroccan feminists worked largely with internal social and political forces, while Iranian feminists have operated transnationally as well as internally. Cyber activism is more characteristic of the Iranian feminist campaign than of the Moroccan. And interestingly, whereas Moroccan feminists turned to the language of emancipatory and egalitarian Islam to make their case before a kind of a pious public, Iranian feminists have, in a sense, rejected the Islamic discourse of the state, preferring to adopt frames from Iranian secular political history, such as references to the Constitutional Revolution, to the concept of Senf, and to the Global Human Rights Conventions, frames that also resonate with a largely modernized and secularized citizenry. Thus, even though Islamic feminism was a discourse that took shape in Iran in the early 1990s, they actually moved away from it. The women's rights activists have moved away from that discourse. What are some of the lessons of a wider relevance, then, for the study of, and especially comparative study of, women's movements? First, for women's movements, the global environment matters, as does the domestic, political, and cultural context. Although the Moroccan campaign was similarly initiated under conditions of state repression in the early 1990s, it had the benefit of a propitious global environment, shaped as it was by the UN's preparations for the Fourth World Conference on Women, which took place in Beijing in 1995. In contrast, the Iranian state today is interested neither in accommodating domestic movement actors nor in acquiescing to the global women's rights agenda. Among other things, this raises the stakes and makes politics more contentious. In a more positive vein, the study of the feminist campaigns in Morocco and Iran shows that feminism has become truly global, and that collective action strategies travel from south to south and no longer from north to south. In other words, from the global, you know, from the west to the rest of the world. The ideas travel within the global south as well. After all, the Iranian 1 million signatures campaign was adopted from the Moroccan 1 million signatures campaign of the early 1990s. The Iranian case also shows that dissidents may turn to transnational allies for support when there are no elite allies within the country. Now, for those of you who have read Keck and Sikhing's book, Advocacy Across Borders, this is the argument that they make. Their boomerang thesis basically posits that when opportunities are foreclosed from local activists, they appeal to allies transnationally, to international organizations or some friendly state like Sweden or something. And then some pressure is brought to bear on the local authorities, and then the local authorities acquiesce. Well, sometimes that works, but not all the time. And certainly it doesn't work in large, semi-peripheral, powerful states like Iran, with the advantage of strong militaries and oil revenues at their disposal. So some smaller, weaker states will respond to this international pressure, but states like Iran don't have to. Fourth point that I want to make the last point, is that the study of the two movements and the campaigns confirms the link between feminist activism and broad societal democratization, or the ways by which political opportunities and movement outcomes are mutually reinforcing. In the case of Morocco, not only was the political environment conducive to women's claims making and movement growth, but the feminist mobilization itself has contributed to the expansion of political space in Morocco in the form of political quotas for women, a vibrant press, and new civil society partnerships and campaigns. In the Iranian case, feminists are firmly committed to democratization, but they continue to operate within a very untoward political environment. So my questions are, will state repression have a debilitating effect on movement prospects, as some of the social movement literature suggests that it might? The social movements literature, by the way, for those of you who are interested, tends to posit two things, that sometimes repression, state repression, crushes and demolishes a movement, but at other times it actually gives impetus to a movement. So which one will happen in Iran remains to be seen. Or will, alternatively, will the Iranian feminist movement continue to grow and become a leading part of a larger mobilization for democratization? In the summer of 2009, as you all know, the Green protest took place in Iran, and the feminist activists did take part in those protests, albeit just individually. In any event, in that summer, the campaign website, which is called the Feminist School, commemorated its third anniversary with an ironic pictorial reference to the tear gas used by the authorities against the street demonstrators. But that website also included a strong statement of hope from feminist leader Nushin Ahmadi Khorasani, with which I want to end this presentation. And she has said, and I quote, "Moving forward, we need to keep our message alive. We want true democracy in Iran. We need to continue educating the masses so they will peacefully resist the violence of the state. We must teach our children, the young generation, never to forget the history of our struggle. And we must explain to them that justice and equality can best be realized through patience and tolerance." Amen.